The word evangelism comes from a Greek term meaning bringing the good news. So what an evangelist does is bring the good news as opposed to sell. So you can make the case that evangelism is the purest form of sales because evangelism has the other person's best interests at heart, not simply your interests at heart. In daily life, you are always selling, and you know, it may be to get a better table at a restaurant. It may be that you're talking to the person checking you in at United and you want to take a surfboard for free, or you want an aisle seat, or you want to be moved to economy plus or first class for free, or you know, something. So I think you're always selling. So this means that you need to perfect your pitch. You need to know how to sell. You know, people who position themselves as experts or gurus or thought leaders, you know, I mean, if you want to be called an expert, guru, or thought leader, then do something great. I think that those things come about, that kind of positioning and branding comes about because people accept that you have done this. And so I'm just a little leery, shall I say, of people who are self-proclaimed experts. But when all the dust settles, if you've made meaning, if you've made the world a better place, you will probably also make money.
Welcome to episode 98 of American Real, where this week I have an online conversation with Guy Kawasaki, a 15-time author, brand evangelist, and entrepreneur. If you want to get a dose of humility, true humility, listen closely to this episode and Guy's words of wisdom. I took away so much from this conversation, including what it means to be a brand evangelist, perfecting imperfection, and the definition of Guy's golden touch. Guy talks about his relationship he had with Steve Jobs and the impact he made on Guy's career, his role with Canva, and his latest venture with Merge 4. In addition, we discuss honor, social media, live video, and podcasting. We talked about Guy's interview with Brian Rose on London Real, but out of all the things we discussed in our conversation, this quote resonated with me most. Honor between people who are honorable is probably more important than paperwork between people who are dishonorable. So sit back and relax as I welcome Mr. Guy Kawasaki.
This is American Real. I am Roger Brooks. My guest today is Guy Kawasaki, marketing specialist, author. You are responsible for marketing the Macintosh computer line and bringing appeal to the word evangelist. You are the author of 14 books, and your latest is titled Wise Guy, Lessons from a Life. Guy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is actually my 15th book, and I must admit I've lost track too. I was employee number 5,000 or so at Apple, so I wasn't really one of the first ones. And my task in the Macintosh division was to evangelize software and hardware developers. So I wasn't responsible for the overall marketing of Macintosh. I was just developer marketing. So set the record straight, because truth is at such a rarity today.
No, and I appreciate that. And look, you're right, that especially with social media, and you obviously, we're going to talk about that today. It's easy to get lost sometimes. You know, if you're on the other side with words, and I appreciate you actually correcting that. What does it take to be a good evangelist for any?
Okay. So first of all, to set the record, not straight, but to set a base, the word evangelism comes from a Greek term meaning bringing the good news. So what an evangelist does is bring the good news as opposed to sell. So you could make the case that evangelism is the purest form of sales, because evangelism has the other person's best interests at heart, not simply your interests at heart. So that's the foundation. I think 90% of being a great evangelist is having a great product or service. This is called Guy's Golden Touch, which is not that whatever I touch turns to gold. Guy's Golden Touch is whatever is gold, Guy touches. And so it was easy to evangelize Macintosh. Today, I'm chief evangelist of a company called Canva, and it is an online graphics design service, also easy to evangelize. So my inside tip for anybody who wants to be an evangelist is to find or create something great, because it's easy to evangelize something great, and it is hard to evangelize crap.
So let's talk about Canva. Yeah, I love that app. What an incredible app.
And I actually started at it 5 years ago before, you know, it was what it is today. So it wasn't easy to become the chief evangelist of Canva, but it is easy to evangelize Canva, which is a crucial difference. And the reason why it's easy to evangelize Canva is because it's so dang good.
And did they find you, or did you find them?
They found me because my social media person, or actually, I actually report to her in social media, she was using Canva for Twitter. And they figured out that I was using Canva, and they reached out to me.
Awesome. What do you like most about that app?
I like that it levels the playing field for graphics, that you don't need to buy something or rent something expensive. You don't need to spend weeks and weeks learning it. You don't need special training, certification, anything like that. You basically, you know, get an account, then you pick the kind of graphic that you want, book cover, album cover, presentation, social media graphic. And then you go ahead and you find a template that you like, you customize it a little, and bada bing, bada bang, you're done. And that is a beautiful, beautiful experience.
It is. And when you look at a company like Canva, Guy, I think about, okay, what's Canva going to look like a year from now or 3 years from now? Where can a company like that go? How can it expand?
Well, we make, let me say this accurately. So more than 100,000 new customers join Canva every day. And we make roughly 3 million graphics per day. So we've kind of arrived at a critical mass point. Having said that, you know, right now, I think most people are using it for pictures. We'd like to include video, also presentations. So you never have to use other presentation products, let's just say. Sure. And there's also, you know, creation of websites. There's a lot of work left to be done in graphics. We want to basically be the one-stop shop for designing and graphics.
Incredible. It's a wonderful app, and it's so great that you're involved with that company, and I can't wait to see where it goes.
You know, how hard could it be to evangelize Canva? I mean,
it's like Mercedes, right?
Well, yeah. You know, another case of Guy's Golden Touch. Yes. I'm a Mercedes-Benz brand ambassador.
But Guy, really, I love your humility, because look, you've worked hard to get to where you are. You know, it wasn't by mistake. I love how you say, you know, maybe the only non-celebrity or non-athlete to endorse some of these products. But look, I mean, you deserve it. You really have you know, gone through an amazing career and worked really hard and put out all these books and content and information that people like me learn from, you know, on a regular basis. So, but I love that about you, your humility, and it's just incredible because it gives entrepreneurs, you know, kind of a level set of, okay, you know, this is Guy Kawasaki, but Guy Kawasaki, you know, he's also that real guy. He's that person that gets it. So I just appreciate
it. You know, once you start believing your own bullshit, man, it is a slippery and steep slope.
So, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of it over the years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have a theory that, you know, the dumber you are, the more you think you know. So.
I like that. So your TED Talk, which you did several years ago, it's called The Art of Innovation. Loved it. You made some really good representations in there. One of the things you talked about was make meaning. When you're involved with innovation, make meaning. Could you talk just a little bit about that, why that's important?
Yeah, so my observation is that the companies who have truly succeeded have made meaning. That is, they, in the words of Steve Jobs, dented the universe, that they made the world a better place. Apple has made the world a better place. Google has made the world a better place. Canva has made the world a better place. And so I think that is a quality that sometimes entrepreneurs forget. They're just trying to make a buck. They're trying to, you know, get more eyeballs, whatever it is. But when all the dust settles, if you've made meaning, if you've made the world a better place, you will probably also make money.
So it's really important for people to put that first and not think about the money first. It's hard to do, right?
It's very hard to do. And you know what? To be honest, when you're two guys in a garage, two gals in a garage, a guy and a gal in the garage, you know, you may not be thinking about denting the universe. But I'm just saying that when all the dust settles, if you are successful, you probably have dented the universe. Maybe the exception to this is investment banking, right? So in investment banking, you can make a lot of money and not make the world a better place. Let's just say.
Right, right. No, and I like how you put that, denting the universe. Most people say, you know, change the world. And until recently.
Those are both Steve Jobs terms, okay, to be honest.
Okay. But to be honest with you, you know, when I, in the past, before I become more thoughtful about what people are saying, when someone would say change the world, my initial reaction was, yeah, right. How are you going to change the world? But you can change the world in a way that could affect people directly and then indirectly.
Well, you know, I would also say that I don't want people to go away from this discussion thinking that, well, unless they're Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or Thomas Edison or Walt Disney or, you know, somebody like that, to Branson, unless you're one of those kind of people, you haven't changed the world. But I don't think that's at all true. I would say that, you know, probably every teacher every day changes the world because teachers are influencing kids, the next generation. So, you know, you don't have to be a Steve Jobs to change the world. You could be, you know, a fifth grade English teacher.
Great point. Also in that TED Talk, you talked about a few other things I just wanted to quickly mention. Don't worry, be crappy.
Yeah. So don't worry, be crappy is my pun on don't worry, be happy. And what I mean there is the first version of your product is going to have flaws. Now, I'm not saying you should ship crap, but I'm saying that, you know, you can't wait for a perfect product and a perfect world. Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn likes to say that if you don't cringe when you look back at your first version, you didn't ship fast enough. You should cringe. Now, obviously, I don't think this applies to, you know, biotech, but for software, for, you know, web services and stuff, you know, get it out there. Get it out there.
How about for books? Because you put out a lot of books now, 15. Yeah. Where does that lie within writing?
Well, you know, as an author, I am very, very just obsessed with putting out the perfect book. And I will tell you, it's not possible. So I've had literally hundreds of people review my latest book, Wise Guy. And then a professional copy editor did it, and then a professional proofreader did it. And there are still mistakes in that book. Now, I'll give you some of the subtlety of some of the mistakes. So in Wise Guy, I talk about how I played hockey in Slovakia, but the caption of the picture says Slovenia. I talk about this instance where there's a guy dancing in the field, and the point is that until the second person joins him dancing in the field, he's just a nutcase. But when the second person joins him, then the third, fourth, fifth, and I attribute that to Simon Sinek, but actually it's Dan Sivers. So, you know,
it's never going to be perfect.
I am just amazed. Yeah. So now I can't tell you that with my book, I say, oh yeah, don't worry, be crappy. Just push it out. Don't worry about copy editing, because that just offends me that there's, you know, those three mistakes in there.
Sure. Well, I've been working on a novel now for 7 years.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm at that point where I know it can never be perfect.
Yeah.
But I don't feel it's quite ready. Is there a difference between being ready and actually getting it out there?
Yes. I think after 7 years you need to ship. I relentlessly pursue perfection for about 6 months. but you know, copy editing is a little different than the totality of a novel. But I can't imagine working 7 years on a book, because if it took me 7 years to write a book, I'd be 105 today. You got
right. And in fairness, you know, I wrote a business book, and that took me about 8 months. Okay. So,
okay, good, good.
This is something new to me. I never wrote fiction before. So mm-hmm. I had to learn that craft. I had to learn how to do dialogue, you know, it definitely was probably a 3-year process. And I started working with a coach after, it's getting to that point where I need to release it, because, you know, I need to move on.
Yes. Yes. I know the feeling.
Well, great. I'm glad we talked about that. The last thing in your TED talk, you talked about perfect your pitch. How important?
Yes. Well, I think that maybe you're not an entrepreneur trying to raise venture capital, but you know, in daily life, you are always selling. And you know, it may be to get a better table at a restaurant. It may be that you're talking to the person checking you in at United, and you want to take a surfboard for free, or you want an aisle seat, or you want to be moved to economy plus or first class for free, or, you know, something. Or, you know, in business, you're getting people to buy your product or service. You're trying to get someone to join your company. And of course there is investors too. So I think you're always selling. So this means that you need to perfect your pitch. You need to know how to sell.
Awesome. Steve Jobs, you've said that he fundamentally changed your life.
Yes.
How so?
Well, without him, I would not have, you know, been in a Macintosh division, because it didn't exist. And the Macintosh division launched my career in tech. You could make the case that I'm living proof that if you do one thing pretty well in your life, you can coast for about 40 years. So, you know, where would I be? I was in the jewelry business prior to Apple, really. And, you know, maybe I would still be counting diamonds today. Thank God for Apple and tech. Not that I didn't enjoy my jewelry experience, because the jewelry experience laid the foundation for my Apple experience, because in the jewelry business, I learned how to sell.
Interesting. Guy, I'm sure you get the same questions from a lot of people, and I don't want to do that to you today.
Okay.
But I do. If there's one lesson that you could take away from Steve Jobs, you've talked so much about him, what would it be?
I think the most important lesson of Steve Jobs, well, there's two. First, customers can't tell you how to truly innovate. They can tell you how to make what they're getting from you better, faster, and cheaper, no doubt. But can they tell you, if they're buying Apple IIs from you, can they tell you how to make a Macintosh or what they want in a Macintosh? Not at all. And I don't blame them. I mean, because the context of of the relationship with you is based on what they're already buying. So that's number one. And number two, I think Steve Jobs did not care about race, color, creed, gender, sexual orientation, anything like that. All he cared about was competency. And he was way ahead of his time being, you know, blind to all that kind of stuff. He just wanted competent people.
Excellent. You gave a speech the day after Steve Jobs passed.
Yes.
And you completely changed your presentation that day, from what I understand.
Yeah.
How important was that for you to do that on that day?
I don't want to portray myself as this dramatic figure that did something awesome. He was very important to the universe and very important to the Valley, very important to Apple, obviously, and very important to me. I think the world is a lot less interesting place without Steve Jobs. But understand that at the time that he passed away, it wasn't, a sudden thing, right? People knew about his cancer and all this kind of stuff. But I just happened to be making a speech in a tech surrounding for Silicon Valley Bank. And, I just decided, why not? I mean, pay tribute to the man that brought us so much.
Right. And you talked about the 12 lessons you learned from him that day. Mm-hmm. One of those were experts are clueless, right? Avoid people who refer to themselves as an expert. I never really heard it said like that.
Well, my take on this is that, people who position themselves as experts or gurus or thought leaders, if you want to be called an expert, guru, or thought leader, then do something great. But don't do it because you're trying to self-brand or self-position yourself, okay? So, I think that those things come about, that kind of positioning and branding comes about because people accept that you have done this, not because you published a white paper or a book or given a speech. And so I'm just a little leery, shall I say, of people who are self-proclaimed experts. Like I said earlier, I think not only the dumber you are, the more you think you know, the flip of that also works, which is the less you think you know, the more you probably do know.
Interesting. You talk about not getting stuck on, you say, religion. You give the example about when the iPhone first came out,
yes,
Third-party apps were not permitted,
yes,
other than the Safari plugin.
Yes.
So can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so the point there, and the point I'm trying to make in Wise Guy, is that Steve Jobs did 180-degree reversals. So when the iPhone came out, it was a closed system. A year later, he opened it up. How many companies would have done that? That is 180-degree reversal. And most companies would say, well, we can't do this. We'll look like fools. We'll look stupid, et cetera, et cetera. But it was the right thing to do. I think that's an important lesson. When you realize that you made a mistake, correct it. Don't perpetuate it because you're afraid of your image or your reputation or anything like that. Just fix it.
And was Apple famous for doing that with a lot of things, even things that we wouldn't know about, making that reversal?
Well, I compared to most companies, I don't think Apple has made that many mistakes. Having said that, I would say that today, if you look at Apple, I think there are some things they should reverse. And I'm not involved with Apple anymore, other than, I go to the Apple store and I stand in line and pay full retail just like anybody else. But there are some things about the product that I just don't understand. So,
can you give us an example?
For example, if you bought a MacBook today, it has two USB-C ports. It doesn't have an SD card reader. Doesn't have HDMI. Doesn't have USB 3. And so you have to buy dongles to do all that kind of stuff. And maybe every millennial never plugs in anything to his Macintosh except power. But I've got to believe there are people like me. You know, I have a external hard disk. I have a Dymo twin turbo label printer. I have Evernote scan snap scanner. So that's three right there. And I still want to drive an external monitor. And so don't get me wrong. You can buy docks and dongles to do that. But man, it's so nice to just be able to just, you know, have everything on your computer. Because you always forget your dongle. And then if you're lazy like me, you kind of need three dongles because you need one at home, one at your vacation, you know, wherever you're going on vacation, then one in your bag for when you're traveling. And then then you got to have the right cables. I mean, it's just on and on and on.
But that's an interesting topic. And I guess the question comes to mind for me, like who would make that decision? Who within the company or organization would make a decision like that? Because it's a big decision.
I have no idea. I would really have loved to have been in the room when they decided to kill MagLite or MagSafe. Because right now, MagSafe, I can see from across the room that my computer is charging or fully charged, right? And it can be closed. What a concept.
Right. So
it probably charges faster closed than open because the screen's not on, right? And so right now, with a recent MacBook, you have to open it up, wake it up, and then look, see if there's a little lightning bolt in the upper right-hand corner. So believe it or not, in the last month, I bought a 2015 MacBook Pro because it has just about everything I have. I am talking to you now from a computer that's 4 years old. And I never, ever in my life thought I would ever go backwards 4 years to buy a computer.
Wow, that's really interesting. Very interesting. You once talked about desktop publishing saving Macintosh back in the day.
Yes.
Tell our listeners why back then was that so important? It wasn't really planned, right?
No, not at all. So again, I cover this in Wise Guy, and what I try to illustrate is the concept that you never know, and don't be proud, and you know, be happy and declare victory, because we thought Macintosh would be a spreadsheet database and word processing machine. Come to find out, it was good for desktop publishing. We never intended for desktop publishing. Desktop publishing was a gift from God and Aldous and Adobe, and it saved Apple. And the lesson that I learned is, yeah, take your best shot at positioning and brand, but then the market tells you truly, you know, what it wants to do with your computer or your phone, and then declare victory. Don't be stubborn. It's a very valuable lesson.
And hence the need to be really flexible too, right? And,
yes,
and listen to your customers.
Well, it's not only be flexible, it's not don't be proud, right? Some people say no, you know, it's a spreadsheet database word processing machine. Don't use it for desktop publishing.
Right. Trust. How important is trust in business?
I would say it's everything, although right now it seems in our world it's nothing. So the stories I tell in the book about trust is that two people, Steve Case and Patrick Lohr, and actually three, Bruce Livingston, these are examples of people that I had no sort of formal deal, no paperwork, no nothing. And when they cashed out, they remembered me. And they didn't have to. I would not have been upset if they didn't, but they remembered me. And that was literally millions of dollars. And I learned a very valuable lesson, which is that, you know, honor between people who are honorable is probably more important than paperwork between people who are dishonorable. So I guess in a perfect world, you'd have paperwork and honorable people. But if you had to pick one, pick honorable people.
Well, I love that. I love that. And is it true that when you talked to Steve Jobs, you said something to the effect, "That's okay, Steve. I don't trust you either."
Yes. This was a meeting of the marketing people at Apple the second time I worked there. And the agency person who had come up with the concept of the Think Different campaign showed it to us. We all loved it. And he said, well, I have two copies of the tape. I'll give one to you, Steve, and one to Guy. And Steve said, don't give one to Guy. Give me both copies. So I said, you know, Steve, what's the matter? Don't you trust me? And he said, yes, I don't trust you. And my counter was, well, I don't trust you either, Steve.
And where did that lead to?
That led to years of poverty for me. Well, what's a few million here?
You were on London Real back in 2015.
Uh-huh.
I trained under Brian Rose, and yeah. Just interested to see if you followed his growth since the time you were on, because it's changed a lot since that day that you were in his, you know, makeshift studio in his apartment.
I must admit, I have not followed. I don't know what his current, you know, shtick is. Sorry.
No, that's okay. And it's actually pretty incredible. He's probably one of the top 10 podcasters in the world, bringing on amazing guests. Yeah, you were there at a time right before his growth, and he is now training people like me and hundreds of others around the world, getting into this business, because it's through this type of connection that I feel we're able to grow as people. So for the listeners of our show to be able to listen to you and hear your views, that means a lot. I mean, you know, 10 years ago when we didn't have the technology, maybe it couldn't get out too much, but you know, now thousands of people, if not tens of thousands of people, are able to benefit from this. So I was just curious because I listened to it back then, you know, your interview, and it's just interesting to see his growth with the trend of podcasting itself. As
maybe he can have me back. I should ask.
I would love to see that, actually, and I certainly can.
If you talk to him or email him, will you ask him? I would love to go back.
I definitely will. As a matter of fact, I'll send him a clip, and he could hear it from you himself.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Speaking of podcasting, what's your take as a technologist? What's your take on the whole podcasting world, where it's going?
You know, I think, you know, lots of people are telling me that, you know, podcasting is now truly arriving, and I think it had a big inertial. I think it had a big initial spike, and then it settled down. But now it's coming roaring back. And I've often considered that I should do podcasting, but it's so much work. I mean, just the editing. Oh my God!
Well, that's why you have to partner with people like me to do the hard work for you. So all you have to do is talk.
Well, it works for me, man. I can talk. I can't edit.
No, it is. It is a lot of work, in all seriousness. Yeah. And we typically have people in our studio face to face, like you did with Brian. We have 5 cameras on a typical day.
Oh my God.
You know, so it is. It's a lot of work, but again, I want to be able to do conversations like this, because if someone's listening on the other end, it really doesn't matter. And it's just as important for me to be able to connect with people like you. So I agree with you. I think it's now in its second stage of tremendous growth.
Yeah.
And it's going to be exciting to see where it goes in the next, you know, few years.
And what's the typical business model? Sponsorship or selling ads, or how does that work?
Great question. It's not. And I was actually going to ask you about this. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Brian Rose as an example.
Yeah.
So he did his show for maybe 4 or 5 years without generating any money, maybe a little bit of ad money. Okay.
Really?
Okay. Until a couple of his guests came on the show and said, Brian, you need to do something with this. You have a tremendous audience, a captivative audience who's listening every single week to your show, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you need to sell them something of value. So Brian Rose started the London Real Academy. And the London Real Academy teaches people like me, who've been avid listeners of his, the podcasts. So obviously you're not going to get tens of thousands of people to do that, but you'll get hundreds. You'll get hundreds of people paying thousands of dollars to learn how to do something like that. So his academy is his main stay for income. So he teaches people how to give TED Talks. He teaches people, he has a course called the Business Accelerator, where you could take any business and, you know, turn it into something of value online, where you're able to sell a product or service.
And he does this all in person, or
he does it all exactly what we're doing now on Zoom. So he'll have a call with, you know, 100 people, 150 people that are all listening to him give, you know, twice a week, a live interaction. And then it's supplemented with videos and worksheets, all with an accountability document where you could keep track of your progress.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of work. God bless them.
It is. It's a lot of work, but I think it's pretty fulfilling for him, and a lot of people are benefiting from it. Cool. But it's boomed. You know, it went from zero to 10 million plus in revenue in less than 3 years. So he's doing pretty
good.
That's
great.
Yeah. So Guy, back when you were on London Real, you said something like this. You said, "I'm not a big consumer of social media. I'm a producer of social media."
Yes.
Can you explain the difference to people?
Yeah. So I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but you know, for me, I've taken the social out of social media in a sense, because I'm not trying to be social. I'm not trying to find more soulmates and buddies and friends. You know, I have one wife and four children and one dog, and that's about all I can handle. So I'm not trying to socialize. I'm trying to promote. I'm trying to educate. I'm trying to inspire and entertain. So my model for social media is, if you provide value, you earn the right to promote. So the value I'm trying to provide is curation, which is I find good stuff around the news sites, YouTube, whatever, and I am acting as a filter to bring you the most interesting, best stuff, my filter, which you may agree or disagree with. And so my value is curation. My creation is when I write a book. So I've written this book, Wise Guy, that we've been discussing. And that's my creative, you know, avenue. But my curation is to find good stuff. So I want to find good stuff that entertains, informs, you know, assists you. And I'm trying to earn the right, just like NPR earns the right and Wikipedia earns the right to run a fundraiser. In my case, my fundraiser is buy my book, use Canva, drive a Mercedes. I'm also helping a company called Merge 4. So I met the entrepreneur from this company. It's called Merge 4. And they make just the world's coolest socks. So this is, you know, a surfer sitting in the ocean. And this is a cityscape. And so there's all these like skeleton ones and just the funkiest stuff from all these skateboard artists. And I'm helping someone sell socks now. So I'm kind of at that stage in my career where I just do whatever I enjoy doing.
And have fun.
Sell socks and Canva.
That's so awesome. And I've seen you on your surfboard recently. You do some live videos from there. How is that going? You took this up. Later.
Yeah, I took up surfing at 62, and I just love surfing. I'm not that good at it, but I truly love surfing. So,
what is that? Do you use a GoPro, or what do you have?
I use a GoPro. Sony just came out with an action camera. I'm going to try that too, but mostly GoProing, or someone is on the shore using a Sony movie camera or a Sony DSLR.
Awesome. Guy, how important is live video for entrepreneurs and business people today? Should they be live video?
That's a good question. You know, I was all into live video for about a year ago. And that was when Facebook was all into live video. But Facebook has kind of backed off on live video. And so I just have not done it. And for example, and I know this is wrong, I have not done a live video for Wise Guy yet, which is just stupid on my part. So I'm going to have to fix that problem. But I think it's something that entrepreneurs should try and see if it works, because it may not work for everyone. It may not work unless the platform is behind it and, you know, is pushing your live video. There's a lot of variables here, but you know what? I mean, how much does it cost to try the experiment? Almost nothing. So give right. it a shot. And if, you know, if I had a particularly good product that shows well on video, like socks, I would be doing it all the time.
Well, I hope you give it a try, because I really think I've been doing it now, and I see, in my small network, I see a lot of interaction every time I do a live video. I think people would love to, you know, hear about your book, and they could ask you questions on Instagram. Okay. You know, so
you would do it on Instagram or Facebook, or where would you do it?
Well, you have a large following on Instagram.
Like 82,000 or
something. That's definitely big enough. Yeah. For sure. And I would do both. I would try both. And man, if anything comes out of this interview, because I also love to offer be of service to others. So if that's the little piece of value, or
thank you,
I'll be thrilled to see you on live video and see it blossom.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Well, I know you have a plane to catch. This would be awesome. I would love to do an interview in person someday, Guy. To meet.
Where do you live?
I'm in upstate New York. But I do travel, and we take our set on the road. So if we come out to your area, or if you're ever in New York, we have a studio in the city.
Okay.
We would definitely do it in person.
If you get to Northern California, you know, give me a couple weeks warning, and we'll make it happen.
That's awesome.
Okay.
And I have a couple of questions. I'm going to save it for our next interview, and I thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'll call Brian Rose from London Real to see if we
can. All righty.
Thanks, Guy. Take
care.
Bye.
Thank
you. Have a great day.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for tuning into American Real. Be sure to visit our website, AmericanReal.tv, or search for us on iTunes or YouTube for past episodes. While you're there, please rate us or leave us a review, as that helps others find our show. I am truly grateful and appreciate all of your support. At American Real, we're on a mission to help as many people around the world fulfill their dreams and obtain their goals. If you'd like to be part of our inner circle or want one-on-one coaching, check out the American Real Learning Academy, where we have self-help groups and courses so you can build the best you. We also have a new Facebook group where you can connect with high achievers from around the world. If you want to go even further, maybe you're determined to write your own book or launch your own podcast, contact me today to see if we could help. You can reach me through Instagram or Facebook, or email me directly at roger@americanreal.tv. And speaking of podcasting, our next course will be starting soon. So if you're interested in launching your own podcast, join me at Podcast Your Passion. I'll take you through my 8-week course where I'll mentor you to build a world-class podcast. I'm only taking on a small group of people who want to share their passion through broadcasting, where I'll have you up on iTunes and YouTube within weeks so you can podcast your passion. Click on the link below for more information. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.